Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're starting the show today by discussing the prospects of a hunting season for sandhill cranes in Wisconsin. A bill authorizing the hunt is being argued by state lawmakers this month, but the issue has been debated among hunters and conservationists for years, and we'll take a look at the pros and cons of it on the show today. With us to begin, Brad Heidel is executive director of the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association, and he'll talk with us for the first half hour and hopefully getting your input as well as we move along. How would you feel about the state creating a hunting season for sandhill cranes? Are you maybe a member of the International Crane Foundation? Let us know your thoughts. You can call us. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Brad Heidel, welcome back. Good to have you with us. Thanks for joining in.
Hey, good afternoon or good morning, Larry. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm wondering how you're doing. The status of establishing a sandhill crane hunt in Wisconsin is kind of ongoing. What's the status of it now?
You know, right now the status is that it has passed out of both committees here at the state capitol, and we're hoping to bring this to a vote on the floor here before this session ends.
If it all passes, I would imagine there'd be some sort of tagging system offered to hunters.
Yeah, you know, and that's yet to be determined, depending on the structure that the Department of Natural Resources put together. But there will certainly be hopefully will pass, and if it does, this will be a strictly controlled hunt through the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And whether they use that as a we'll look at that as a tagging type system, as you know we've seen in the past many, many moons ago when I was growing up with the Canada goose, or maybe it's a call-in type registration like they do with a lot of the different species today. Yet to be determined.
Yeah, I was thinking about the elk hunt, where there are a lot of people apply for permits for elk, and just a few are given out. But it might be something similar. It could be something similar, I presume, with cranes.
Yeah, I would guess it would be. And, you know, and one of the things I just wanted to bring up, I was listening to your opening comment here, and you said something along the lines of, you know, this is being debated by conservationists and hunters. And I'd like to point out that hunters are probably some of the biggest conservationists in the state of Wisconsin, let alone the United States. You start looking at the North American model, which is such a successful model for our wildlife here in the United States, including the state of Wisconsin. And, you know, if it wasn't for hunters / as conservationists, we wouldn't have the wildlife that we have today.
Yeah. Oh, I would certainly agree with you on that. And maybe talk spend a minute or two on the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association itself and what it does.
Yes. So we are a waterfowl organization. You know, we represent roughly the 61,000 waterfowl hunters here in the state of Wisconsin. And our mission is three ways, three different things, actually, three pillars, if you want to call it that. You know, first is going to be wetland restoration. You know, just in 2025 alone, we had a direct impact on over 8,000 acres here in the state of Wisconsin. So putting a lot of habitat on the ground for ducks, geese, cranes, as well as other wildlife. And then we also have our R3 program, which is recruitment, reactivation, and retention of hunters. You know, we want to keep our strong waterfowl heritage alive and moving forward here in the state of Wisconsin by bringing new hunters in and keeping the ones we have and reactivating those that may have slipped away. And then the third part of our mission is obviously going to be the advocacy part of it, where, you know, we're spending a lot of time at the Capitol here And this last half of 2025 and moving into 2026, we're advocating for the waterfowl hunter, and we're advocating in behalf of the sandhill crane hunt and hoping that moves forward. But we're also advocating in other areas. I'm here at the Capitol today in support of a bill to in reference to wetland delineation, and hoping that we're going to be able to streamline that process for people to get permits from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources to create more wetlands. And then certainly not least is Knowles Nelson Stewardship Fund. That's something that we're also advocating for on behalf of the Wisconsin Waterfowl Hunter here in the state capitol.
So lots going on there. Why are hunters interested in sandhill cranes and hunting? Are they good eating and so forth?
Well, absolutely, they're good eating, but I don't think that's the main goal. And I'm going to go back. I'm just going to tell you a quick story. And maybe you grew up doing the same thing as I did. I grew up in Green Lake, Wisconsin, and I remember our biology teacher. His name was Tom Eddy, and he would gather all the biology students up. And every spring, which they still do today, we would go out and do the sandhill crane hunt, or not hunt, the sandhill crane count. And, you know, you got to spend some wonderful time out in the wetlands counting sandhill cranes. And what a wonderful success story going from where we were in 1984 when I was doing those crane counts to where we are today. You know, we have a population goal set by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service of 30,000 cranes here in the state of Wisconsin. Right now, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is telling us we've got over 112,000 cranes here in the state of Wisconsin. What a wonderful success story. But with that success also comes some problems, right? Mm-hmm. Or agriculture, in for the most part, has seen some significant losses due to sandhill cranes. And we would like to help with that problem. I think we can help with the population, control the population with a responsible hunt. But make no mistake about it, it's not all about helping out the farmers, which is one thing that this is going to help with. We also want the opportunity to spend some time in the field and hunt some sandhill cranes.
Jim in Hortonville has a question. Let's go to Jim. Thank you for calling, Jim.
Well, your guest pretty much scratched the surface of the fish and wildlife piece, and I'm sure that they'll play a big role in establishing quotas. The larger concern that I guess I have living in the Hortonville area, north of us is the Navarino Wildlife Area, and there's a lot of cranes that stage there when they're migrating, and it seems like the bulk of those are on private land. And my concern is the guides are going to get in there and get leases buttoned up on those lands, and it's going to become pretty much a pay-to-play proposition for us hunters.
Hmm. Jim, thanks for calling. Brad, do a comment on Jim's thoughts.
You know, Jim, I appreciate you calling in, and I appreciate your concern. My thoughts are this, and it's strictly an opinion, is we don't have a whole lot of guys and outfitters here in the state of Wisconsin. That would some guys and outfitters probably be taking advantage of the opportunity to hunt some sandhill cranes? I would say yes. But for the most part, I think you're going to see a lot of opportunities to hunt sandhill cranes on private lands, especially working with some of those farmers who are having those deprivation issues.
I'm thinking about the Horicon area for geese, where many farmers there, you're allowed to hunt on their property, and maybe they have a small charge, but not too much, but it's just the farmers themselves. Jim, Jim, thank you very much for calling. You know, there was a study, I think it was conducted by the UW Survey Center. About 17% of state residents would support a sandhill crane hunt. And then I think 48% opposed the ideas. I'm wondering where you see support for the hunt.
Sure, absolutely. And you know what, Larry? Anyone can pull together a survey to get the response that they want. And the survey that was put together by that UW system was actually charged or put together with the International Crane Foundation. So, of course, you're going to be able to ask the questions that you want to ask. And you also will have to base those questions around context and what was the context. So I would take a good hard look at that survey and see how the questions were asked. Because I could pull together a survey of our members, and I have done that, and I can tell you that over 94% of our members are in support of a sandhill crane. But, so it all depends on who's asking the questions, what those questions are, etc. Anybody can get a survey to come out the way they want it to.
The population is about 110,000 or so. We've talked a lot on this show about high pathogenic avian influenza. What's the concern that bird flu might be endangering the population of sandhill cranes and maybe lower their populations to unhuntable numbers?
Sure. We haven't seen that here in the United States. And I can also tell you that the system that would be in place is a system that is a pilot system. You know, it's a 3-year pilot. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has the ability to end a hunt at any point in time based on population risks. And so this will be a very, very closely monitored hunt, not only by the state agencies, but by the federal agencies. And if something like that were to happen, they would shut it down. Hmm. And guess what? Everyone would be okay with that.
Brad Heidel, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association, he's given us his view on the proposal for a sandhill crane hunt in the state. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at sandhill cranes today, Brad Heidel, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association, his organization is in favor of a sandhill crane hunt. Jonah in Greenville has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Jonah.
Hi, thanks for having me on. So I'm just looking for a little more context for why sandhill cranes were so endangered in the first place in the 80s or prior. I don't know the exact timeline. I'm just going based off of what we were talking about today. Was it previous hunts that went too large and unchecked? Was it an ecological issue, like some sort of disease? I just want to know more context so that myself and other listeners can either like or dislike the idea of another crane hunt more. I just think more context, please.
Okay. Brad?
Yep, I would say that's a fair question. And one thing I am is always open and honest, and I don't have a good answer for you, and I apologize for that, but I don't. I can tell you that it wasn't over hunting because there has not been a sandhill crane hunt in the state of Wisconsin for a very, very long time, if at all. But that being said, what I can tell you is if you look at waterfowl, which we would call sandhill cranes as part of that community, whether it's ducks, geese, cranes, et cetera, you know, those populations that have regulated hunting systems are actually growing, whereas the other populations of birds, which you're going to be looking at songbirds, we'll call them backyard birds for lack of a better term, those are drastically declining by a number of 3 billion right now. So those unmanaged species are losing traction, while the managed species are gaining traction.
Hmm, interesting. And coming up in a bit, Brian Michalesko might have some more context on that part, too, about why sandhill cranes were endangered back in the 80s. We can ask him when he'll be on with us in a little bit, and we can talk with him about that as well, Jonah. So stay listening for that context. I think there was about, 200 farmers reported just under $2 million in crop damage, or they do report each year. They're unable to receive payments for crop damage unless the DNR authorizes a hunt. The current bill, I don't think, includes farm-specific provisions which would have been paid for by hunter fees. If there's a hunt, can the DNR afford the abatement bill?
You know, that is a fair question. The answer is yes. In the long run, they can. The abatement bill will continue to grow with the number of hunters and with the increased license sales. So that is a base fund that is set up, and that's for all deprivation, whether it's for geese, cranes, elk, deer, et cetera, turkeys. And this will actually open up that opportunity to farmers where they don't have that opportunity right now. Right now, one of the opportunities and what's being used by a lot of farmers is a deprivation hunt, where they are already killing 1,400 cranes a year based on deprivation hunts on their fields. And those birds have to be left in the field to rot, or they can burn them, or they can bury them. They cannot be used in any other way. And that's just a tragedy. The tragedy that you're not able to use these birds at all. And we want the opportunity to be able to hunt them and to help feed our families and have some delicious meals and some wonderful sporting events.
Robert in Amherst Junction, we'll give you a chance to join in. Robert, hello. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm curious if your guest knows of anybody who's ever tasted sandhill crane meat. Or is it a trophy hunt and they're going to, you know, stick sandhill crane heads up on the wall plaque or something?
I think that's an excellent question. And I can tell you this, that they do hunt sandhill cranes in 17 other states and several provinces in Canada. And I personally have hunted sandhill cranes and eaten sandhill crane, and it's absolutely delicious. It's absolutely delicious. There's so many different ways that you can cook sandhill crane. They're a wonderful bird. And I do not see a lot of people using this as a trophy hunt. I see it more as a opportunity to eat a sandhill crane. They're that good.
My understanding is the consistency of them, it doesn't taste like chicken. Let's put it that way, or have the consistency of chicken.
It doesn't. And for lack of either way, I'll tell you this. People call it the ribeye of the sky.
Yeah.
It's that good.
More of a consistency of what you might consider a steak than...
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so I wanted to bring up one issue that somebody else has raised, and that is a worry that hunters might mistake sandhills for whooping cranes, which are, of course,
yep,
endangered. Has that come up in your conversation at all, Brad?
It has come up. And, you know, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service defines Wisconsin whooping crane flock really as an experimental and non-essential. It's intended to, you know, prelude this experiment from preventing a sandhill hunt from really being considered. And I'm going to tell you another quick story, Larry. My wife and I were out looking for some turkeys this spring, and I got really excited. And my wife's like, what, a big tom turkey, big tom turkey? I'm like, no, it's a whooping crane. It's the first whooping crane that I have seen in the wild in my life. And I was really excited about it. And we have our Waterfowl Hunters Expo every year up in the Oshkosh area. We have over 10,000 people attend that event. And the International Crane Foundation has been part of that event since its inception. And what I can tell you is I took that picture and I showed it to the folks from International Crane Foundation, and they were just as excited about it as I was. They could have told me exactly what bird that was, when it was released, et cetera. And come to find out, it was a juvenile bird that was just recently released last fall. If I could show a picture to you on the radio, I would. But there's no mistaking a whooping crane from a sandhill crane. One is white and one is brown. Can't miss it.
Yeah, I think there is quite a difference in the look. Deb in Trempealeau County emailed a note contrary to the comment you made, who said the hunt will definitely help farmers. They farm 800 acres of corn and soybeans, to which sandhill cranes frequently visit. They get little to no damage, appreciate seeing and hearing them, and they're welcome at the farm anytime. She's not in favor of the hunt.
Mm-hmm. Understood, and not everyone is. But I can also tell you there's a lot of farmers that are. You can talk to the Wisconsin Corn Growers Association, and they'll be the first to step up and say, we need this to hunt to help our farms out.
Hmm. And Ralph in Hayward emailed us and says maybe you meant to say that the abatement fund could grow if license sales increased. He suggested that license sales are increasing, or you suggested that, but that's contrary to everything you hear about hunting licenses and interest in hunting in general across the state, which has been on the wane for quite a few years.
Sure. No, understood. And but in this case, the Sandhill Crane licenses would be a new source of income for the DNR and a new source of income for that abatement fund as well.
Yeah, that makes
it would be another fee that would be adding to that fund.
Mm-hmm. Going forward, how will your organization support the creation of a sandhill crane hunt season?
You know, we want this to be a science-based decision, not an emotional decision, a social decision, if you will. And we would work hand-in-hand with not only the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources to make sure that this is a responsible sandhill crane hunt, but also work with our federal agencies to ensure that as well. I can tell you, hunters and fishermen, hunters in this case, care just as much about the sandhill crane population as everyone else in the state of Wisconsin. These are birds we all love, we all cherish, just like the white-tailed deer, just like the wild turkey, just like the Canada goose or the mallard. Love them, but we also love the opportunity to get out in the field and pursue.
Brad, a pleasure talking with you today. Appreciate it very much, and we'll probably be talking with you again down the road. Thank you, Brad.
Thank you, Larry.
Brad Heidel is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association. Great to talk with him. Coming up, we're going to hear a differing view about the hunt. And Ryan Michael Esko up next from the International Crane Foundation, our guest. Stay with us. Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to take a different view, a contrasting view from our first guest today, as we visit with Ryan Michael Esko. Ryan is the Communication and Advocacy Specialist at the International Crane Foundation. And we're going to talk with Ryan about the Crane Foundation's view on this, and certainly want to get your thoughts as well as we move along. Should the state open a hunting season for sandhill cranes or not? It's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. Ryan Michalesko, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Larry. Great to be here.
We were talking about the history of the hunt. I guess there's never been a hunt before, a traditional hunt for cranes, but there have been proposals before, have there not?
Yeah, you know, this is the third or fourth time in about a decade that this proposal has been brought forward, and the prior times it's always failed. We're hoping the same thing will happen this time because it is definitely a big concern for us.
And the foundation's position on this?
Yeah, you know, since this all started almost a decade ago or more than a decade ago, this has always supposedly been about helping the farmers. And in reality, we think it's really been about having a hunt, but we're trying to find solutions that'll help the farmers and really work with them to resolve this issue of crop damage by cranes. It's an important one for us. It's one that we have worked on for nearly 30 years in our study area around Briggsville and Baraboo, where we're headquartered. And it's one that we continue to work on and invest in.
Yeah. I visited the foundation many times over the years. I love the new setup, which is now a couple of years old, but fantastic to see. And maybe spend a minute or two on what the International Crane Foundation does.
Yeah, you know, the International Crane Foundation is really the world's leading experts on cranes and crane science. But more than that, we're really a Wisconsin story. We were founded and established right here in Baraboo, Wisconsin, over 50 years ago. And we've been here since, working in Wisconsin's communities, but really taking the work that we do here in Wisconsin and reaching around the world with it. So now we have a footprint in more than 50 countries and 150 staff working on these same issues that we have in Wisconsin all around the globe.
It's an amazing story, I think. And funded by... How's it funded?
Yeah, a little bit of everybody. We have a really strong group of, we call them craniacs, but our members all around the world, but also, of course, incredible funding from government programs and private donors and foundations and really, really everywhere you could think of.
We talked in the first half hour about the management plan from the Midwest, Mississippi and Atlantic Flyway Councils. Can call for a potential hunt once the numbers reach, 30 to 60,000, I think was the number. And our population's at 110,000. So by this measure, the current population could support a hunt.
You know, that's what we hear often. And sandhill cranes, there is no doubt that they're a conservation success story. You know, less than 100 years ago, famous conservationist Aldo Leopold wrote in his piece, Marshland Elegy, that he thought we would hear the last sandhill cranes. He would, right there around Baraboo at his shack on the Wisconsin River. And since then, we're blessed that population has come back. But of course, with that are the struggles that come along, like crop damage. The management plan that's set forth by the Flyway Council, that was established to really figure out how to bring that population back, how to continue supporting it. And unfortunately, that number that's set forward in the management plan has been taken out of context by a lot of those folks who support a hunt. They say that's the minimum number needed to have a hunt. And in reality, that's the minimum number for intervention. Should the population get that low, we need to step in and do something. We need to start thinking creatively to save these birds.
Mark in Wheeler has a comment. Let's go there. Mark, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you for letting me on, Larry. The last guest said that there were $2 million in crop damages from cranes. The Wisconsin corn crop is valued somewhere to $6 to $8 billion. My quick calculation is that for every $10,000 worth of corn that a farmer sells, cranes are costing him $3. Is that too much to ask farmers to, too much of a burden for them to bear?
You know, I think we have to think about the big picture here, which is that there are a lot of farmers in the state who are running smaller farms, who are running family farms, and they certainly are going to be hit much harder than those larger corporate farms. But to really get into the finances of it all, I think the actual estimate is about $1.2 million in reported damages, not two. And when we get into that damage abatement program, which is really where that number comes from, there's not an actual census of how much crop damage is occurring, unfortunately. We know it's probably more than that, but that number comes from the damage abatement program, which currently pays out money for farmers and landowners to provide depredation efforts to prevent damages from deer, bear, turkey, things like that. And that piece of legislation, that statute says that sandhill cranes can be opened up to that damage abatement program should a hunt be authorized. And unfortunately, as we're hearing about this, you know, there was a whole process to write a bill that would create a hunt and include a lot of really great programs for farmers in that bill. That bill has been stripped back to where this is pretty much only a hunt. It would still open up that damage abatement program, but during both the Assembly and Senate committee testimonies, we heard from the state migratory game bird biologists that fund would be completely overrun by Sandhill Crane reports. So not only are we not putting enough money into that fund to actually help farmers through this bill, we are draining it for the farmers that already rely on it for other species.
Mark, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to go back to the history part of it because we did have a caller earlier wondering why the numbers had gotten so low to begin with. What was the cause?
Yeah, you know, if we think back 100 years ago, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act was passed in 1918. That was certainly a really important part of this, but unregulated hunting, habitat loss, destruction of wetlands were all very crucial parts of the sandhill crane and whooping crane story. Fortunately, sandhill cranes have been able to rebound, but whooping cranes haven't done so successfully due to a number of theories, but their numbers got so low that they just don't have the genetic material to rebound. So we have a lot of concerns about both species still.
Brian in Janesville has something. Let's go there. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Ryan. I have been a hunter for 50 years and a crane hunter for 35 years. I've also been a member of the Crane Foundation for about three decades. And it was very interesting when this first came up, they tried so hard to stay neutral on it. And it's evolved now that I really feel like no matter what hunters or biologists say, that the Crane Foundation is opposed to it. And, you know, the population can certainly withstand it. We're hunting this crane population in three states in the flyway now. The proposal, as I understand it, is for 1,000 or 1,200 cranes harvested, which is less than the number farmers are shooting on crop depredation permits in the spring that they don't even get to use. So I feel like there's room to try this, and I just can't believe if you reduce the population by, say, 10%, you don't drop the population and the crop damage by 10%. The juvenile cranes are the ones that are causing the corn damage in the spring, and that's probably the population you're going to hunt because they're not quite as smart as the paired-up older birds.
Yeah, there's a few things to break out of that, Brian. First off, thanks for being an ICF member. We appreciate your support, of course, and definitely want to hear you out on this issue. As this has been brought up in the past, the number of permits that could be given out, and this would really, again, come down to the Fish and Wildlife Service and the DNR, but it's probably closer to the 5,000 mark. It's really hard to say without all of the data. But unfortunately, in terms of the science, you know, ICF is really the leading experts on this issue. Of course, three other states in the flyway are hunting sandhill cranes. And I'll just point out that there are 17 states, as Brad mentioned earlier, that hunt sandhill cranes. Those three are the only three in this population. But with all of this, we have a lot of other concerns that we don't hear these groups talk about often. We have a lot of concerns about the fact that Wisconsin's a breeding area. The three other states that have a hunting season are not breeding areas. When you have long-lived birds like cranes that take a long time to breed, and very, very different from ducks or geese or waterfowl, which cranes are not, they don't lay 8, 10, 15 eggs a clutch each year. Cranes only lay one or two eggs. When you have birds that live to be maybe 30 years old, reducing the population and taking out some of those breeding birds could have effects on the population that we're not able to understand simply because there's not the data. And that's a big part of what we're trying to get across, is that we don't have the information to make a good judgment on this, and neither do the groups that are calling for a hunt. The Fish and Wildlife Management Plan is over a decade, two cycles out of date. It hasn't been updated or looked at. And the state has no data because there's no hunting season. And unfortunately, the really sad part of this is the bill that has been put forward through the Assembly and Committee strips out all of the money for the DNR to do any reasonable science on the issue.
Yeah. Brian, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too, if you have a question or comment, want to join in, give a call. The number 800-642-1234 or email us to talk@WPR.org. Kay in Stoughton emailed us, when is the proposed time frame for the hunt, and will the timing impact the success of juveniles as they stay with their parents for the first season as they return to their winter migration destination?
Yeah, well, this is one of the really important things about a hunting season in terms of resolving crop damage, is that, of course, crop damage occurs in the spring. A hunt would occur in the fall. We believe, and we've heard this from also the DNR, who testified on the record to the legislature, that a fall hunting season is very unlikely to impact crop damage. We've also heard from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, to point back to one component of Brian's question earlier, is that the goal of a hunt is not to reduce a population. In fact, that would be a very bad thing if we're reducing the population through a hunting season. So it's kind of one of those issues where you can't have it both ways. We can't say we're going to reduce crop damage, but we're also going to reduce the population and have a safe hunt. In terms of chick productivity, I just want to throw out some recent research from just this past year. And again, we've been studying and banding sandhill cranes here in Wisconsin for more than 30 years. In our study area, where we go out and we look for these banded birds to return, we found that the number of marked breeding pairs in our study area decreased by 32%, and only one in five of those breeding territories produced a chick. So that's lower than past years. We're still trying to figure out why, but one of our concerns is this could be due to the highly pathogenic avian influenza that we've been discussing. Last spring, HPAI took out probably, again, hard to get a firm number, but probably around 4,000 or 5,000 birds in Indiana, Tennessee, and Kentucky. When you have a population that's only 100,000, we're talking full percentage points here, and that's a big deal.
Here's another part of that. How will a general open hunt help farmers that have crane damage, since they're already allowed to get a permit to shoot cranes? Just because someone kills a crane, we will never know that it is one that caused the damage.
Well, of course, you'll never know which, unless you're out there watching them, but occur. Of course, a hunting season would occur in the fall, so you're not going to be watching as you're hunting either. And you know, we hear this a lot from groups like Brad's, is that, you know, the depredation permits are terrible, and they are a challenge because, you know, those birds can't be used. But unfortunately, those permits aren't going to go away. When a hunting season occurs in the fall, but crop damage occurs in the spring, farmers are still going to be applying for those depredation permits. And I'll also point out that the legislature, through the Legislative Study Committee that met on this issue now almost 2 years ago, sent a letter to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service requesting that those depredated birds could be consumed or used by the farmers. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service responded and said, absolutely not, because that would create a de facto hunting season, which is against the law. It's against the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. And it's just a bad precedent all around.
Yeah. There has been an argument that hunters have helped animal populations. They hunt, and I think that's true in many cases. The example This person uses the wild turkey because they're required to purchase a turkey stamp. Hunters contribute, I guess, $700,000 or $750,000 or so to the projects in the state. So the question is, why not encourage the same kind of support for hunting for cranes?
You know, this is a really good question and one that I'd love to get an answer to. Of course, hunters are a valuable part of the conservation mission and certainly work towards these efforts to conserve the lands and waters that we all rely on. But in this specific case, the math just doesn't add up on a few levels. And I just want to point out something really important here, which is that Brad said that the amount of funds coming in from hunters applying for sandhill crane permits would be able to supplement that damage abatement compensation program. Unfortunately, that's not the case. According to the DNR fiscal estimate, the sandhill crane hunt would operate with losses estimated at about $400,000 a year. However, the bill has been amended to remove most of the farmer support, to remove all of the education components that the DNR could have set up, to remove money for research and management. Now that bill costs taxpayers $1.6 million in losses a year and doesn't help the farmer. So, you know, it really doesn't make a lot of sense in that regard. And on the other part of this is that hunters do contribute a lot to this mission, but so do non-hunters. And there's a lot of non-hunters in this state. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, I don't know if everyone's heard of this, but they conduct a really important survey about recreational activity in the United States, and this goes in conjunction with the U.S. Census. And in 2022, that survey showed there's an estimated 148 million people who identify as wildlife watchers, 96.3 million people identify as bird watchers, and only 14.4 million people identify as hunters. Certainly not to knock down the hunters by any means. Hunters are great. Hunters are important, but you know they're not the only people that are constituents and worried about these birds.
Bernadette in Baraboo, we'll go to you now. Hi, Bernadette.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Yep. So I've heard that. I just wanted to save and bring this up, but I heard and I remember listening to programs that they talked about coating the seeds and having programs with the farmers where they can coat the seeds so the cranes don't want to eat them.
Avapel, I think, is the...
That's right, Larry. You know, Avapel is a non-toxic seed deterrent. This is a product that ICF, the International Crane Foundation, has absolutely zero stake in the product itself or the company. However, we did help with the field testing back in the 90s when this product first came out. And the research shows and the conversations that we have with many farmers show that this product is overwhelmingly helpful in terms of deterring cranes. But I just want to push this back because the unfortunate thing is for more than a decade, these two issues have been tied together. In reality, a sandhill crane hunting season and crop damage are two completely separate issues. But unfortunately, and if I were a farmer too, I would take the free option if I was being told there was one that's going to work, even though now we have ample evidence that says a hunting season's not going to help farmers with this issue. So Avapel's a great product. We still work to try to get that in the hands of farmers, but that's another thing that we're working on. We're trying to work with the legislature to split these issues apart to establish a program that would help farmers get funding for Avapel and really make that product more accessible for the folks who need it most.
Yeah, I assume there's probably an expense associated with using it, which is the...
As with everything.
Yeah, which is the roadblock for, seemingly the roadblock for many.
Seemingly the roadblock, but again, if you're being told that a hunting season's going to solve all your problems, why not try that first, even though we have all of these concerns and say it's not going to?
Yeah. Georgia in Cambridge, thank you for calling.
Yes, I just wanted to comment that the first speaker asserted that there was no knowledge of any problem with avian influenza affecting crane population. And my understanding is that there was just this last spring, there were 30,000 cranes died of it in Indiana last spring.
Hmm.
The number is not quite as high as 30,000, but there is certainly a large die-off of sandhill cranes in Indiana, Tennessee, and Kentucky, probably about 4 or 5% of the population. And we had birds infected here in Wisconsin. Unfortunately, this past fall, we also lost the first known whooping crane to die of highly pathogenic avian influenza, which was certainly a devastation for us as well. And since then, two more whooping cranes in Canada in the Aransaswood buffalo population, which migrates between northern Canada and Texas, have died from avian influenza. So it is certainly a concern, but the big thing is that in Europe, there is a species of crane called the Eurasian crane, or the common crane, sometimes it's referred to. This is the second most abundant species of crane next to sandhill cranes, and probably those most similar to sandhill cranes and how they rely on agricultural areas next to wetlands. They consistently have large, unprecedented outbreaks of avian influenza in Europe that have caused the loss of up to 80, 100,000 individuals. When our population is only an estimated 112 individuals, that would, you know, completely wipe out the population. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but it's something we need to be concerned about, and we can't not acknowledge these issues at hand.
Georgia, thank you for calling in. Jake in Madison, your turn. Hi, Jake.
Yeah, thanks for the show, and I appreciate the balanced, two-sided ideas from NPR. It's great to hear. I have two quick questions. Was the hunting side proposing any sort of limits on guns or ammunition that you can use for the hunt? And then was there also an animal that has gone away that used to control the population?
Predator population, yeah.
You know, I think that in terms of the restrictions that would be built into a bill like this, this bill's unfortunately been really stripped down. So the International Crane Foundation, as well as to Brad's credit, the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association, a number of other organizations participated in what's called a legislative study committee, which was held at the Capitol. It was a six-month long program that we met monthly to meet and discuss this issue. And that bill, or that committee, put forward a bill that, like I said, had all of these really important programs and rules, and most importantly, the extra funding for farmers and education, outreach, and management of the population. Unfortunately, that seems to be a bit of a Trojan horse. As soon as that bill made it to the Sporting Heritage Committees in both the Assembly and the Senate, it was rather quickly amended to remove all of those programs. So really what's being put forward right now is a hunting season, and that's about it.
Yeah, yeah. Jake, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And so, our going back to the first caller we had at the start of the show, one of the first callers who was a hunter but also a member of the International Crane Foundation, and wondering, in the past you'd been neutral, and now you're in opposition. Maybe why, or in the last minute, is that going to be continuing to be your stand?
Yeah, no, this is our stance, and unfortunately this has been a long issue for the International Crane Foundation and for sandhill cranes in this state. Again, this is the third or fourth time it's been brought up, and as a science-based organization that employs some of the best researchers in the world, we really try to stay above the fray on issues like this, but when proponents of a hunting season are putting out a lot of wrong messages and wrong information and bad data in regards to this issue, I think it's important that we get involved and make that known. You know, this is our time to stand up for the birds.
Ryan, I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I appreciate it, and I'm sure you and I will be talking down the road. Thank you
so
much.
I'm sure we will.
Ryan Michalesko is the Communication and Advocacy Specialist at the International Crane Foundation. And by way of full disclosure, we should mention the ICF is one of Wisconsin Public Radio's many business sponsors as well. So we appreciate that as well. So interesting, and I think a good hour as we talked about the pros and cons. And we are going to switch our attention and talk to the author of a new book. It's called Anthropause, The Beauty of Degrowth. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're turning our attention now to a new book. It's titled Anthropause, The Beauty of Degrowth. And our guest is the author, Stan Cox. Stan writes about the economic and political roots of the global ecological crisis. He's the author of seven books, including The Green New Deal and Beyond, Ending the Climate Emergency While We Still Can. And as we talk with Stan about his book, his new book and latest book, Anthropause, want to hear from you. What are your ideas for how we could live more sustainably? What could you live without? How do you imagine a sustainable food or transportation system working? Give us a call. The number, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Stan Cox, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
It was great to be with you, Larry.
I appreciate it, and I found your book very interesting. And it started, as I understand, or your idea for it started back in 2020.
It sort of did. My editor, just a couple of years ago, he gave me a call and said, "I've got a title for you. You can write a book under this title, and it's a one-word title, and it will draw a lot of readers." And I said, "Well, what's the word?" And he said, "Anthropause." And so I said, "Okay, I'll look that up and see what it is and get back to you." But he was right. I don't know about how it'll draw readers, but he was right. It's a very interesting phenomenon. The term was ecologist in the spring and early summer of 2020 used this term as to describe that period during which we had COVID lockdowns over much of the country and world. And there was a remarkable resurgence of nature just in that short time. And we saw pictures of wild animals wandering around in Times Square, and the birds were singing more, and their greenhouse gas emissions dropped by 20% worldwide temporarily. There were pictures of people in India looking off on the horizon and seeing the Himalayas for the first time. And so I thought, okay, that the story of the anthropologist would make a good opening parable, sort of, for a book about degrowth. And of course, it's not that we should advocate another lockdown, a permanent lockdown of people in their homes, but we can look through the anthropology and see what is all the stuff that we normally do that was suspended and allowed the Earth to recover at least temporarily. So it's not that our bodies weren't present out in the world. It's that all the stuff that we do out in the world, especially in the course of supplying our economies with more and more extracted resources, fossil fuels, minerals, land territory, et cetera, that we were not intruding on the earth as much. And so then I went on with, that's just the beginning of the first chapter, and then the rest of the book is about degrowth.
Yeah, and this whole concept of degrowth, there are several definitions of degrowth. Tell us which we need to know for this discussion.
I guess first it's good to say what degrowth is not, yeah. and that it's understandably misunderstood, I guess, because people just will assume that it means we have to reduce the gross national product shrink our economies, but everybody needs to be poorer, but that's obviously not it. The core concept of the degrowth movement is that the one essential thing is to reduce the quantities of fossil fuels and other extracted resources, especially minerals, that we are putting through the economy, that are they're being taken from the earth, used to produce a lot of stuff, much of it either unnecessary or outright harmful, and then all of that ending up waste at the other end. That sequence has to be interrupted, once you do that, though, the degrowth movement emphasizes, you have to be much more careful about how we use the resources that we're still using. That is, to fulfill people's basic needs, improve well-being for everybody, with equality, and so forth.
Yeah. Some people, at first glance, some people might be scared of degrowth because you're talking about, in some ways, sacrificing what people might view as life's luxuries or things that they become accustomed to, I guess. But you call these happy subtractions. Subtractions.
Yes. When people, first, Larry, there's an interesting study published recently in which they surveyed people in the U.S. and U.K., and half of the people, they just asked them, what are your feelings about degrowth? Should we have a degrowth economy? And then they don't explain what that is or anything. And three-fourths of the respondents say, no, I don't want that, because they've been told all their life that without growth, civilization is going to end. But the other half of the population that was surveyed were given a description of what is envisioned with degrowth from the researchers who are advocating it, and all the stuff I just described, to say we're not going to waste resources to produce simply to produce profits for the upper half of the or upper 10% of the income wealth earners, And we're going to, it's all going to be used to improve everyone's well-being. And then 3/4 of the respondents said, yes, yeah, let's have that. So, in the book, what I, the central argument I tried to make is that people, as you say, people are still going to, even if they understand what degrowth is, there's going to be worry about what am I going to have to give up? What sacrifices am I going to have to deal with? And I decided just for now, let's do a thought experiment and say that we do achieve a degrowth economy. Instead of thinking about the sacrifice and so forth, let's look at all the terrible things in our economy and society today that are made possible by overuse of fossil fuels and other resources, and say, okay, if we do drastically reduce our use of those things, how many of those ills and harms and annoyances and nuisances that we deal with today, how many of those will be subtracted from the economy? We won't have to deal with them anymore. They'll be in the past. And how will people's lives be better?
Yeah. You might talk about, or you do talk about, I shouldn't say you might, you do talk about degrowth as a way to solve societal issues, like racism even.
Right. And those solutions would be byproducts of having reduced our impact on the earth. I got into a few seemingly small things that that you would think, well, for example, leaf blowers, you would think, well, we're not going to save the earth by getting rid of leaf blowers. But no, it's the other way around. Doing what is needed to keep a livable earth will mean that we can't have the horrific noise pollution from leaf blowers. There would also be a justice element to it, because of like 80 or 90% of gas-powered leaf blower use is by commercial landscaping companies, and the employees of those companies are very often they're poorly paid. Many times recent immigrants, they're often people of color, and they're getting that noise from the leaf blower, which is approximately it's like standing right next to a jet engine when it's just the leaf blower engine is just a couple of feet from the ears, and even ear protection isn't all that good. So that's a very micro example. A much bigger one, I should say, that is very relevant today, because it's what is in all the international news is that, you know, with a degrowth society, we would not in any way have the resources that are needed to run our $1 trillion a year military industrial complex. And you know, a degrowing society and world could not afford war fighting in preparation for war fighting. Mm. And so I argue in the book that the 3.5 million people who are employed in and around the military would, in the U.S., would have a great improvement in their quality of life. And the rest of the world would obviously be much better off.
Our guest today, Stan Cox. His book is entitled, the main title is Anthropause, subtitled The Beauty of Degrowth. Questions or comments, I hope you'll join in. The number 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're visiting with author Stan Cox about his latest book titled Anthropause, The Beauty of Degrowth. And again, you can join in, number 800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. And let's take a call. Kate in Washburn, what's on your mind?
Hi. So a number of years ago, the author Barbara Kingsolver wrote a great book called Animal Vegetable Miracle. And in there, she talks about that if every family just ate locally sourced foods for one meal a week, it would significantly reduce the fossil fuel use because of reductions in transportation for foods that we are in the have the luxury of eating all day long or all year long. Like, you know, do we really need to have our strawberries in January? But it seems like a sacrifice of local food for one meal a week, and if everybody did that, it's not that big of a sacrifice, and it would make a big difference in fossil fuel use. So there's just one idea.
Yeah, Kate, thanks a lot for calling. Comment on that, Stan.
Yes, you're exactly right, and Chapter 4 of Anthropause is where I deal with the food system, and it really needs to be completely overhauled, because right now the farmer's field is just is kind of at the center of a whole bunch of industries that are parasitic on it. The equipment and chemical and fertilizer industries, and especially all the industries that support the feedlot and confined animal feeding facilities, those industries are generating lots more wealth, you can call it, than the farmers producing, and they're also having much greater negative impact on society. And then downstream from the farmers, you've got the grain trading companies, the as you say, the transportation of the food, and then huge food processing industries that take quite good, nutritious food and turn it into something that's not really food. And then it continues through the retailing, restaurant industries, et cetera. And so all of that stuff is much of it is unnecessary. And as you say, the as much localization of food production as possible is needed. And this is another area where there will be great leaps in socioeconomic justice, because in order to have strawberries in winter and all that kind of stuff, there has to be a huge, highly exploited workforce in California, Florida, et cetera, and in Mexico. So that, with that and in many other ways, overhauling the food system would rid us of many of the ills that we're experiencing.
Yeah, I think you reported in your book that 90% of our cropland goes into like four crops: corn, soybeans, cotton, and wheat.
Right, and only one of those four crops is something that humans eat directly, except for tiny bits of sweet corn, which is a very tiny part of the corn crop, and a little bit of food-grade soybean. And the rest of corn and soybeans go to feeding animals. And so it's only the wheat that we're eating directly. And the feeding of corn and soybeans to cattle is doubly wasteful, because they are not built, their bodies and digestive systems are meant for eating vegetation, leaves, et cetera, that are grasses that are very high in cellulose and so forth, and so you put 10 pounds of corn into cattle, and you get 1 pound of actual nutrition out of them.
Hmm. Mark in Wisconsin Dells has some maybe a little pushback here. Mark, hello.
Yeah, hi, Larry. How are you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I've thought about this subject quite a bit, actually, because I have neighbors that drive up to Wisconsin from Illinois and other states every weekend to go to their lake houses. And I'm thinking, when that has to end, there'll be dramatic effects on the economy of Wisconsin because of the tourism industry and everything associated with it. The answer to the problem, potentially, might be electric cars and a lot more charging stations. And before I get any comment to my comment, since I got you on the phone, I want to say we're going to miss you when you retire. And a suggestion for a show would be to discuss the psychological dysphoria that you're going to suffer, like we all do when we retire. Things change.
Things change, yeah. Well, and Mark, thanks for those comments. I'll be Stan probably doesn't know this, but I'll be retiring in June after 50. It'll be 59 years on the air. So,
wow! Congratulations.
that's a long time. But to his point, what would happen if we couldn't drive people from Illinois, for example, couldn't drive to Wisconsin? And he suggests we need more electric vehicles. And you do address vehicles quite a bit, and even electric vehicles come in for some problem areas.
That's right. The problem is not just that we have way too many private vehicles on the road. It's not that we have too many fuel-burning cars on the road. It's we have too many cars, period, because many of the problems caused by what one scholar, I use his term in the book, he calls automobile supremacy, that we're putting automobiles' well-being above the well-being of humans in designing our society around them. Electric vehicles cause a lot of the same problems, and their one benefit that they have fewer greenhouse gas emissions. They're not zero greenhouse gas emissions. It's just fewer because their manufacture requires a lot more resources, especially the metals that go into the battery, and they also are drawing on an electricity grid that is still largely powered by fossil fuels. And one more interesting thing about that they're finding out about EVs is that the tires wear out much more quickly, because I'm not sure exactly how it works, but they have a system where they automatically apply the brakes when the car is moving forward, which helps generate a little extra current to go into the battery and charge it. But that also causes the tires to wear much faster, which then produces a lot of microplastic, tiny, tiny particles of rubber going off into nature, which is already a big problem with the current fleet of cars and tires. One dealer says people are coming to him and saying, "Hey, these were 40,000 mile tires, and I only got 15,000 miles on them." So, the bottom line is that instead of having vehicles, whether gas or electric or powered, going from Illinois up to vacation in Wisconsin, we need a much bigger and more efficient passenger rail system that would reach not just Chicago and L.A., but would go into all kinds of places like central Wisconsin, and then you would need other public transportation from those nodes.
Yeah, I was really fascinated when I read that part about the tires, because I did not know that. And a listener called, couldn't stay with us. He says the wear on tires is also from the extra weight of the EV tires, maybe not as much the brakes, but that's a possibility too. Mark, thanks again. Maurice in Madison, we'll turn to you now. Thank you for calling.
Hello. You're probably aware of the work of Herman Daly, great economist. He was the chief economist at the World Bank. So he wrote about steady state economics in the early 1980s. Nobody listened. You could you could go to the UW and see if you can find one economist who even knows about Herman Davy. It's just verboten. I think, you know, it seems, I tuned in a little late, but it seems like you're talking about things we should do. This system will not change willingly. As one great economist in the 1800s pointed out, capitalism contains the seeds of its own ruin. It's going to fail soon.
Yeah.
You know.
Stan, that's kind of, and you talk about that in the book. I mean, all right, there's going to be a lot of pushback on this whole business, but there is going to come a time when we're going to have to do something like it.
Right. Yeah. That's degrowth. Well, not degrowth, but growth is going to end. It's that's inevitable. As the there was a guy named Stein, who an economist, who said his rule of thumb was, if something can't go on forever, it won't. And that's what growth, you know, there's just only so much, there are only so many resources, there's only so much pollution the world can take, et cetera. And so growth is going to end either, if we go on with business as usual, it's going to end in a kind of a Mad Max free-for-all downward spiral, or if pursuing the path of degrowth, we could achieve what's sometimes called a soft landing and have a very different world. Either way, the world is going to have to be very different from the way it is today. And the economists who have ignored what Herman Daly wrote and spoke about for many years they were able to do that because we were still cruising along on burning more and more fossil fuels every year, et cetera, and nothing, it didn't seem like anything was going wrong with that. And now we know that it's taking us toward Mad Max world.
Yeah. Michael had emailed kind of in support of that, saying we live on a planet with finite resources, yet we pursue endlessly the growth of the economy and the world population is still growing. It seems more and more people wanting more and more stuff, kind of inflationary. Yet Michael has never heard the proponents of growth make the connection between a fixed supply of resources and the growing demand of those resources, which is kind of what you're addressing.
Right. And the so-called green growth advocates keep urging that with technology and increasing efficiency more and more, so that you get more production out of the same quantity of fuel or the same quantity of aluminum or whatever the inputs are, that efficiency can just keep going forever. But that, that's not true. You can't get the quantity of resources going into a process down to zero. And in fact, it can't get it anywhere close to zero. So you can make remarkable progress in, say, the number of miles per gallon that you get with vehicles, or at least prototype vehicles, but you're not going to get ones that run on no energy input at all. And if there's a diminished returns, if you are thinking that you can keep growth going forever by through efficiency.
Our guest today, Stan Cox. His book is titled Anthropause, The Beauty of Degrowth. Hope you'll join in with your thoughts as well. There have been some good comments here along the way. You could call us at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking today with Stan Cox, author of Anthropause, The Beauty of Degrowth. And again, you can join us at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Email from Bob, how can reduction in air travel help our environment? And I noted some interesting numbers in you certainly address this. Fewer than 20% of the people in the world have ever flown. And here in the U.S., 12% of the Americans in the U.S. take 2/3 of all flights.
Right. And so, deeply reducing air travel would not impact the majority of people in the world, and it would, as I understand it, the emissions from aircraft, the greenhouse gas emissions, are magnified for a given a quantity of emissions that go out of the jet engine of the aircraft, you get a greater amount of global warming because they're being emitted at 30 or 40,000 feet up in the air. So what I kind of use air travel in the book as one of the that its elimination or deep reduction would not only help deal with climate change, but it would create some of the great happy subtractions, because the minority of people who fly frequently, to them, many polls have shown this, that it's becoming one of the more and more miserable experiences from start to finish. Nobody except for people who can afford to fly first class or elite class and those things, nobody really enjoys flying. It's not something that back in the 50s and 60s, when just a few people were doing it, it was quite an adventure. But it's, the airlines are very good at making you miserable enough that you'll pay extra fees to get another couple of inches of leg room, or actually be able to sit together with your family in adjacent seats.
I was thinking about flying way back a long time ago when one of the airlines, Midwest maybe, I got served lobster for a meal.
Yeah.
And the seats were wide. And you had leg room.
Yeah.
Martha in Menominee, we'll turn to you. Hi, Martha.
What's that? Hey, Larry. Really enjoying this discussion, and I got to say, I got to give a shout out to your guest for considering the health impacts that our society has on minority people who are maybe first generation in this country and take jobs that other people don't want to do. So good on you there, Mr. Author, for putting that out there to the people that listen to Larry's show. But my question is about microplastics and plastics in general. I've been trying to reduce my use of plastic over the years. I just buy, half and half in the waxy cardboard cartons. I try not to use Ziploc plastic bags. I use tin foil or paper instead. When I bake, I try to use, wax paper, things like that, instead of plastic. But I'm wondering if your guest could speak to this. Even when we had the farm, back when my husband and I had the farm, we would use paper feed bags for garbage bags instead of plastic bags. But tell me, I'd like your guest to speak to this and what the army of Larry's listeners could do if we all join forces and quit using so much plastic.
Well, I'm with you on the trash bags. I don't have a farm, or I didn't. I just recently moved from Kansas to Michigan, but in Kansas, one of my coworkers had a lot of animals on his place, and so he would every couple of months would bring me all the empty feed sacks that he had used, and so I was able to avoid buying those big black plastic bags. But now I'm stuck. I don't have a source of those things. But the amount of unnecessary plastic being produced is ridiculous. And in many cities, at least in the world, in Mumbai, India, where my in-laws live, they've outlawed plastic bags, and it's not the end of the world. Everybody carries bags around. I guess there's some U.S. cities too that do that. But on the other hand, whenever I've been visiting somebody in the hospital, or I go to the doctor, I think the practice of medicine without plastic would be it would be pretty much impossible to do much of what's being done. So in a degrowth society, most plastic production could probably be eliminated, but there would be certain uses like that where plastic would still, and fossil fuels would still have to be a few of them set aside to make plastics for things like hospital use, or you can think of other essential uses.
Yeah. Martha, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Yeah, one of the interesting points you talk about, you write about the photos of Peter Menzel's Material World, A Global Family Portrait. And that was really interesting to me, his work and why these photos fascinate you.
Yeah, I think the world's greatest coffee table book, although it's not that big. But what this photographer did was to round up another 16 or 20 photographers, and they fanned out across the all the Earth's continents and went to each one, went to a different country and found a more or less statistically average family, or I guess you could just say the median family for pretty much all characteristics, not just income. Spent a couple of weeks with them, taking pictures and asking them questions and having them tell them about their lives. But at the end of the 2 weeks, then they it was arranged that the family would bring all of their movable possessions out of their house, out of the backyard, et cetera, and arrange them in front of their home and then pose with all of their possessions. And you can imagine that going from Bhutan to Ethiopia to Germany, United States, the Congo, you know, it's such a stark contrast. And what was even more interesting probably is that they asked each family two questions. What is your most prized possession? And if you could have more possessions, what would you want to be able to have? If you can still find it online called Material World, and Peter Menzel, I think it's M-E-N-Z-E-L. He did another one, and that book was from 1994. He did another one in the mid-2000s called What We Eat or something, but they did the same thing, but the people displayed a week's all the food that they would, the kinds of food they would and quantity that they would consume within a week.
And it was, and the difference in terms of the size, the amount, is just kind of a staggering difference. And, you know, here we are coming up to the end of our show, and we haven't gotten into a third of what you write about in your book, which is fascinating. But I liked your last line in your book, where you say Western society must act as if the world can have a livable future. What we should not do, however, is to expect that a better future will look anything like our present. And I that's kind of the point. And you talk about all of the differences and all of the things that probably are going to happen whether we want to or not. And let's try and do it in a way that gives us a softer landing than what could be the case. And really fascinating, Stan. And I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today and talking about your book, Anthropause, The Beauty of Degrowth. And Stan Cox is the author. It's great to have him with us and great to have you listening in today on the show. I want to thank you so much for that. And, of course, a big thanks to our normal normal folks here who produce the show, Clara Kniper, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and thank you for listening. And please stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.